question, but not given what I've seen in research and AIDS. I mean, they have the data. Now I saw some statistical part in here. Is it all going into a central statistical place?
Yes, part
and they will
of it,
not be able to control it so that you won't have to go begging them for their part of the data?
I mean, CDC?
Yeah, I mean, you know.
CDC, this is an interesting part of it, because CDC doesn't have the money for a data center. Allergy owns the data center completely.
So that does give us control.
Right. But they're not going to have everything that CDC does. Like, if CDC says, well, we have these special projects that are not part of the core, we don't want you, allergy, to see any of this. It's our, you have to go with that. You know, I can't, there's nothing I can do about
but
that.
Well, but the data center will have the core.
Right.
So that information won't be there.
But then, I think they would be willing, though, to share it, because, I mean, it would look so stupid in public for, you know, say, allergy to have a whole bunch of stuff that they published and they released freely and CDC withholds it, you know?
So CDC's never been one for trying to avoid looking stupid.
Right.
I mean, when it comes to protecting their own interests versus looking responsible, they almost always come down on protecting their own interests.
Well, then, you know, then you got to point it out to them. And with a study like this, where there is a central data center that shelters all the data, basically, they have less of a choice. Also, the committees that decide on what to do with data are not going to be a single agency. They're going to be composed of everybody who puts in money. You put in money, you have a voice.
That's the other question I want to ask you.
Right.
So you say that the WIS study, that there are like five or six other agencies or institutes that want to put money in. Is there really an advantage to that? I mean, you know, part of what you're talking about here is, and maybe that's why so much of this research I've heard all week is so bad, is like, you know, it's a political compromise that has practically nothing to do with the essential questions.
Right.
Okay. And the more agencies that even the issue of the core, mm-hmm. okay, you know, you can say that there's a particular core and that, you know, everyone's going to agree to it, but if it's a compromised core, which, you know, in the best of all worlds, it would be, you know, a set of questions that people compromised on as being very important because they might really give us some new information.
Yeah.
But in the real world, that's not what happens. What happens is, like, who has the most muscle to flex, you know, and in fact, very often, it's what information people don't want to see that gets out of the core, you know, for political reasons. And so it's
actually, that's something that a lot of us have been trying to think about, too, because we've all seen that also. And I think that the way to work the other agencies is that they put money in for a specific thing, a specific sub-study, like NIMH, if they're interested in, you know, neurological outcome or whatever. That's what they do, you know, and they do that thoroughly. They do that all the way. So you can separate out who did what, you know? And so you don't have, like, 80 agencies all squabbling, and then you got to go for lowest common denominator and do...
But you also have a specific subset of women. I mean, you know, when a woman comes to a study, if you finally get somebody to agree to be in a research study, and there are 14 nested protocols, you know, and they have to show up at some other thing, you know, in order to get neurology done, or some, you know, you're lowering your possibility of the, you know, of having people stay in a research study. So in some senses, it's not always positive. Also, you know, I know that huge amounts of data that were in the MAC study have never even been analyzed.
It's true of every study I've ever seen, that maybe 20% gets analyzed. It's always true. It always happens.
And just our experience at the ACTGs this week, there's been a lot of talk about 175, the speaking gene profile, and this is very structurally to feel a little similar, in that the situation with 175 is it's this huge trial testing combination therapies, and it's going to take up a huge chunk of ACTG resources. It's going to last for the next, like, 4 years. And so everybody, all the researchers, instead of trying to come up with their own individual trials, are trying to nest it into 175 and get their questions answered through this trial, because they know that that's where the bulk of the money and the bulk of...
And they know that what the study is about is useless.
Right, you know, and so I'm glad that other agencies are interested in being a part of this. And on the surface, at least, it's a very encouraging thing, because I know how difficult it is for agencies to collaborate sometimes. My concern is that they're doing this instead of being willing to do anything themselves, and that they're taking this large group of women, that they know someone else is going to be finding children and saying, okay, you ask us these questions instead of possibly working through their community networks, which might possibly give them a community that, I mean, a group of women that more closely matches the questions they're trying to answer.
Those are really legitimate concerns.
They might be overusing these persons, right, too. I mean, yeah, that all, you know, the dental research, the this, yeah, the that, the, you know,
they'll get lots of manicures, they'll get, like, massages. I think that what we have to be very careful about is, you know, after that 1987 directive that said that, you know, the NIH had to include women, and then, of course, they didn't. And then, you know, in 1989, 1990, there was yet another statement that they were supposed to do it voluntarily, and they weren't, and there was a threat of this bill that was going to force them to do it. I mean, it's only in their interest to include women, whether they care about them or not.
Right.
So the easiest thing for them to do is to jump onto a study where there's a captive population of women that they don't have to have any responsibility for recruiting or or anything like that, but they can just sort of get their points for having included women.
And
but
who
again,
is protecting the women at that other end?
Yeah.
I mean, we don't know how honest all these endeavors are.
Sure.
They could be the CIA or anyone else involved with this stuff.
Yeah.
You know, especially when you get into the drug use stuff and
right,
so forth. Yeah. You know, I mean, so, you know, in the guise of being humanitarian and you're helping people, you're slipping other agencies in there who knows what their motives are. This should be public information here, all of it. Not that, this particular institute uses our data and we're collecting it for our own purposes. I mean, somehow, the collaboration can be somewhat.
Right, I agree. And I think there are things we need to do to protect. And one is to make sure that if another agency comes in and wants to put a protocol in there, it's a reasonable protocol, it's not going to screw up what happens to the woman when she comes through. You know, you don't want to put an 8-hour neuropsych battery. They really deserve that word, too, on those things, because they're grueling. It has to be done so that there's the community boards, I think, on each of the study sites are essential to protect people on the studies. But need also to be, I think, a community advisory board on the data center, or a place that makes decisions about what protocols get put into the study overall. I think those absolutely have to be there. The other agencies, I agree. I mean, it's nice that they want to throw money, but it's true, some might want a free ride, and that has to be guarded against.
Also, because, you know, I mean, Carrie is not here today. I'll take, you know, the prerogative to tell her story about, you know, being on a clinical trial in which they sent her a questionnaire, you know, asking her questions like, do you wake up in the morning feeling hopeless?
Oh, yes.
And she goes like, what do you
think? No, are you a happy person?
Well, that was the other one, but one of them was like, you know, are you feeling hopeless? She said, what do they expect me to say? You know, I have AIDS, you know, what am I supposed to be, not hopeless? Like, you know, what is this about? And, you know, and then asking her on other parts of the question, like, are you happy every day that you wake up? I mean, really ludicrous questions that are not going to do anything except get someone a paper to publish. That is going to be equally ludicrous.
Right.
You know, and shows absolutely no respect for where people are. And that's what I'm afraid is also what happens when agencies want to, like, bandwagon onto it. I also get very suspect about, you know, the psychosocial parts of interviews, because those are stupid questions. I mean, you know, they speak to not the thing that is most relevant at this moment for the women involved. You know, it's finding out what you can know about them that's going to help somebody else figure out what to do to save their life, not about, you know, sort of frivolous. And I'm a psychologist. I mean, frivolous psychological, you know, state questions.
And also, if you measure with regard to the MAC study, how many, you know, what they're being put through, it shouldn't be, and the women have to go through even more, because somehow, you know, you have to go through more of this bullshit.
Their whole neurological assessment.
They got rid of it, by the way.
Yeah, but they got rid of it. Where are they now? And what was really no good and overkill?
Right, it's important to know neurological information, neurological functioning, but you sort of, it's counterproductive to have, 2 hours of testing.
Oh, yeah, I agree. That turned out to be a huge negative study, right, with the MACs, and it took forever, and it was a huge database. It took a long time to shut the faucet off, when they knew that it was a negative study. So that's the kind of thing I agree we need to make sure that there's some protection against it.
So that I'm clear on WIS.
Yeah.
Is WIS going to include WIT?
No.
And it's not going to include HAPS?
No.
Because HAPS is changing. Now, I understood that HAPS was changing around the Discord and Concord couple. What about the individual women? Is that going to be eliminated, or is that going to continue until 1990, whatever?
It's all going to continue until 1993.
Okay.
And then the future study that I was telling you about that's going to combine basic science and epidemiology, that will pick up after the HAPS. But it's not necessarily
the same.
No, not necessarily the same science. It's going to be it's going to be a new competition.
Okay.
So we're going to start, in a way, start all over again, but also in a way, there will be continuity in terms of the research questions, but not necessarily in terms of the other study.
Okay.
I know, obviously HATS is a different study, but one thing in planning is to keep in mind is, how to keep people in the studies and, maybe doing some back-end analysis of what's been some of the problems with that, whatever, 35% or whatever in HAPS. I mean, it's a different population because they're all negative, but there's still going to be... There's still... What's the percent breakdown that they're looking for in WIS?
For positive and negative?
Yeah.
It's
640.
It's about 500 negatives in the rest of the
country.
But I've been trying to get a good sampling statistician to really work that out better. Because
don't go to the ACTGs.
Don't worry. I wouldn't. But somebody who's really good, because we not only, you have all these different populations, you have to make sure that they're a good comparison group for that particular
right.
site and for the issue of women in general throughout the U.S. So the ratio may change depending on, I think, a really thorough, statistical calculation that isn't just to, put a few numbers into an equation.
Right.
It really considers all the different background characteristics that you're going to be using as comparison.
I have another thing which came up from reading your questionnaire for the HAPS form, and I didn't really get into it then, but about this part about just being sort of culturally sensitive and, the answers you get depend on the questions you ask in terms of drug use, of being able to differentiate between someone who is currently using drugs and someone who has in the past but considers himself to be in recovery, which is an issue that always, that I almost never see in questionnaires.
Yeah.
It's always either you use drugs or
you don't
use drugs,
right.
And there's no recognition of a lot of people have used drugs in the past
right.
and are now clean and sober
right.
and are, they're in a very different category from people who are still using drugs or people who have never used drugs, and that's a place where it's sort of like
right.
ever or never.
Yeah,
it's
the NIDA people actually had a much more comprehensive piece that they recommended to CDC that includes the different kinds of treatment you've been through to stay
different
sober.
Different kind of drugs too, because a lot of people who shoot steroids don't think that they're
that's
what's interesting, because last night we were having a discussion of this, and a lot of women have been getting their HIV positive tests after they've been clean for a fairly long time.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that we were discussing, which I don't know, depending on how the research is done, is that some of the women who took tests while they were using were negative and ended up getting positive tested later on, and we were wondering whether it could be that HIV that the testing of HIV is suppressed by the presence of drugs. Okay, if someone's an active user, just like people are finding out, just like people are finding out that like TB responses, you don't get them in people who are HIV positive because they suppress that, or syphilis, you have to do very often other kinds of tests in order to get it to appear in an agent. So, like, what's the interaction between those two? Because
I've turned through some data like that. I haven't seen anything at all.
I thought Greenwood actually was interested in studying some of those things, the effects of
who was?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, they were. In fact,
looking at how
I haven't handled data sets with that.
How drugs well, I guess one of the things is how drug use interacts with treatment, but I would think that would be certainly a corollary.
Because several people said that that was exactly their experience while they were using the tested negative, and then afterwards they...
And then they were testing, like, with full-blown, too.
Right. Yeah, and by the time they were tested, that's right, by the time they were tested, they had very low T-cells and...
I know some of these stories,
progressed very rapidly.
You know these stories? Some of them, some. From in the early times of testing, the test kits were insensitive. So sometimes they would get an insensitive test, they'd come out negative on ELISA, so they weren't tested left in the blood. Then, you know, later on, a year or two later, they come back for retesting and they're using a better kit and the test is positive. Then when they go and look at the stored sera, do the test with the new kit on the old sera, they were positive all along. Mm-hmm. And that's happened to quite a few people. Mm-hmm.
IVDU?
Yeah.
Or just in general?
The thing is, I see that even now...
I know, it must be people in general, but that's the data I know, though.
I see that it still happens, though, even with the Western blot.
That people who are positive are testing negative
for a while.
Because I do HIV testing.
Yeah.
I don't see very often I do see
right.
This is a question that people had, and that's why, like, specific questions about, you know, how long you've been in recovery and when did you first test positive, if women are seropositive, would be real useful to see if there were any paths there.
I know that. Some of the two IDU cohorts, the one in Montefiore and the one in Baltimore, they can answer a lot of those questions right off. They have the data now. I mean, they can look at people who are active or inactive. They have urine testing to confirm the interview. Yeah. They have,
what is this, John
Hopkins? Blaha for them. I know they have the data in their data sets. They could probably analyze it and see if, because they've been doing repeat tests and people are positive all along. They both those studies have a seronegative cohort of IV drug users, current and former, so they could do it.
Well, also, I went to a couple of meetings of the hemophiliacs, and I have von Willebrand's disease, which is very common in Native American women. And that's a bleeding disorder where the platelets dysfunction. It's the same end result as hemophilia, you still just keep on bleeding, but hemophilia doesn't have a clotting system. My platelet dysfunction. When I go in for an HIV screening test, I'm always positive, always. Western blot is still positive, but a PCR is not. And that happens, I asked the question at the hemophiliac, meeting, and nobody had to see to know anything about or kind of data. But, so those are some of the things, like, for women-specific questions that I personally would like to see. Do you have, or... This is another thing about von Willebrand's, is that you can have it when you're a kid, and it goes dormant until you're in your 30s or late 40s, and then it reactivates again. So they may not know, but maybe they have a family history, especially Native Americans, about 1 out of 4 Native Americans have von Willebrand's. So you may not know it because you're in that stage of life where it's in remission or whatever. And so you don't know. Like, a lot of kids have, your nose is bleeding, you'll grow out of it. A lot of that is von Willebrand's.
Men,
they're hemophilia. Women, granted there's a few female hemophiliacs and granted there's a few male, but it's predominantly, and especially predominantly in the Native American culture. These are concerns for me, and with this HIV testing thing, I mean, I come up positive all the time. It freaked me out the first few times. And still, when I go in for the normal little thing, which I have to do because I'm a volunteer, He freaks me out every single time anyhow. And then we have to do a PCR just to check, and I haven't had a T-cell count done, and part of that, I think, is total denial, because I don't...
You don't want to know.
I have had so many positive test results. How do I know the PCR is right? And I don't want to know my T-cell count. So that's part of my own personal shit that I need to deal with, the denial and all of that. But besides that, then I could be thrown in as a typical Native American half-breed woman. That we don't, there's no Native Americans being studied, especially women.
Well, you know, if that's true, then maybe a lot of Native American women who are testing positive are not
positive.
Why not?
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
It's a whole new thing you've heard about this.
And what is the treatment for von Willebrand's? You either run man-made, like Cutter products, Factor A, DDABP, which for me makes me terribly sick for weeks on end. The reaction is kind of like a chemotherapy. Kind of, you know, you get really sick, you get diarrhea, you're puking, and da 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 da. For two or three weeks, about 3 weeks, until you're starting to feel like, okay, I'm not going to get stand up and have a joint bleed here. So the other option is doing a spin from whole blood and just taking the platelets. So by saving my own life, I'm putting myself at risk. And the Indian, urban Indian centers, I'm sorry, but they get the trash. You know, we always have the reporting system, like in the state of California, all the urban Indian centers, all their alternative testing, you know, all that stuff is federally funded from the BIA. So when the state reports we have 10,000 cases of AIDS, they don't even include the Native American ones because that is not directly reported to the State Office of AIDS because it's federally funded. Now, if you look at the urban Indian centers, their care that they give Indians today, forget AIDS, the diabetes, people's feet and hands are being cut off all the time because of lack of treatment, lack of money, dental care, you know, da 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 da. So then I go back to say, and then you add AIDS on top of it, and it's total failure, just from the financial point. If you want to know what's going on with Native Americans, you have to have a test site, put it on a reservation. They'll be there because the Urban Indian Center isn't giving them shit anyhow. Nothing. And that may be, you know, then we get back into the big institutions to do the research and things, but then we start talking about that mobile unit, and that's where you can really start doing outreach into the reservations. Because they don't talk safer sex. They don't talk AIDS education because they're not funded. They are in a separate, entirely separate funding system than the rest of our society is. It's all federal. And I don't know how the CDC connects in with the Bureau of Indian Affairs, because especially there's still some tribes that are considered prisoners of war, because they were captured and put onto a reservation, and they do not have voting rights as U.S. citizens because they're still considered prisoners of war. So now, does the BIA release their information to the CDC?
I don't think the BIA releases it to anybody.
There was a, I went back to my reservation, which is Rocky Goy in Montana, some Blackfoot, and there's a 91% increase from 1989 to 1991. 91% increase. You know, who the fuck are studying us? You know, we're dying.
You know, another thing that I know happens in San Francisco, in terms of the numbers that do get reported, is a lot of American Indians get put into other ethnic categories, especially if it's, you know, part African American, part Native American, whatever, but a lot of American Indians get categorized as white or Latino.
Is that because somebody else is characterized them?
If you would look at me, would you say I'm white or Indian? You'd say I'm white.
I would see, but
probably stupidly do it.
But actually, yeah, because I mean, what should happen is that you should be asked what you are, so that you can answer the questionnaire.
But even, you know, even when that happens, you know, this issue's come up in San Francisco a lot, where there are people who are from more than one ethnic background, where, you know, a form that says check one.
That happens. Right.
Check one only.
Yeah. You know, got Native American blood from Mexico.
Right.
You know, there's no place for them.
Yeah. My daughter's half Japanese, and she goes berserk every time she has to fill something up.
Right. You know, and a lot of American Indians have, like, when they've been able to compare something where a person has self-reported their ethnic group as opposed to someone else reporting it, that there are large numbers of American Indians who are getting classified as something else, so that it's a whole hidden population that's getting, you know, that's getting stuck in there, which only
you know what you are.
Yeah, but it only increases the underreporting.
Right, exactly.
You know,
yeah.
Maybe I can ask a question about this. This is the thing from the last council meeting.
Right.
Is there a way that we can get a couple of women to come to those council meetings?
Yeah, they're open to the public. They're definitely
like the
yes.
Yeah.
The
council meetings. The one that you went to and talked to Stan, and then I came and gave you the Xeroxes of what was presented. The council meetings, they're really worth going to because everything that Allergy's about to do.
They went to, but they were cut off.
Right, they kicked us off because there was sort of an outbreak of temper tantrum here. They just said, okay, all of this stuff we approve, and they went back to their...
But at those meetings, you basically... So this thing where you were supposed to go on at 3 o'clock, you never went on, is that it?
No, I was waiting to go down there and do my thing. I see the dressed up in the suit. And I said, no, you can't go talk. The council members themselves apparently were screaming and yelling at the Institute because they said they're only a rubber stamp and they really wanted to have some say what went on.
Who's on the council?
It varies. That time it was Janet Mitchell.
Yeah,
it's one of the
Janet?
Yeah.
What?
I
think they served 2 or 3-year terms or something.
Yeah.
Like that.
Yeah.
It's
Janet,
what they call
Janet
the NIAID
yeah.
Council.
Yeah.
So it's the division of aid, the NIAID Council.
Right.
Right. Each
right.
division
right.
has its own.
Right.
There's one overall
right.
council for the whole institute, and then each division, of which there are three, has a subcouncil who
yeah.
are drawn from the major.
And will there be like consistent presentations about the women's interagency study or not? Like, are you planning to go?
It'll come up again because Janet made sure that. She requested that it be discussed in the next one. She said, even though we all approved, we want the thing to get going, we really need to hear more. So it's going to come up again, and the WITs will come up again in January. So.
And those are public meetings, because
the
way Mark
thought
about it, you think you'd have to be invited.
Right, yeah, there are parts that are closed.
There's a part where they have to approve grants and stuff, and that part is closed to the public, but the rest of it is open to the public.
Where is that? Where is that?
It's usually down on the main, in the building 31.
Right, we're about to end it.
I've been there.
And when is it? 23rd, 23rd?
23rd, 24th.
No, the date, but we can get them to you.
On this one, it was
there,
yesterday's January 23rd.
There are
3 times
a year program from the grants office, or whatever
right.
it is. They give you the whole program of when these various meetings are.
Yeah.
They're
3 times a year.
You can kind of call that office to get information.
Right. Did Jean know either person?
Yeah,
from our group. She sets up the meetings.
She gives the agenda.
And they're 3 times a year, January.
Yeah,
April.
The one that it was listed
it
down
was
here
is
being January 23rd.
It's January, May.
This is where
May.
The Division of Applied Research, where the NIDA, you know, that woman, Gloria Weissman.
Right.
Right.
Sits.
Right.
She's at Hearst now. Mm-hmm. She works for Steve Bowen.
What? She's at Hearst?
Gloria Weissman, the NIDA person.
Yeah.
Yeah. She's now. She just moved to Hearst.
Well, where does she work? Does she work at
Hearst? Hearst. But
now.
Oh, I thought you said
she
worked.
She
just.
NIDA.
She just changed
yeah.
jobs.
My
plays
are down.
They have to replace her. They haven't.
They haven't replaced her.
Right.
Okay. Well, I think this is.
It's a lot.
Thank you for
lot.
All your time and stuff.
What did you